Wow. Hi, I'm Scott Jones. I'm director of the Electronic Frontiers Forum's track at DragonCon. And so for this panel, I kind of want to apologize in advance. We actually had
Is that up loud enough? Yeah.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. I want to apologize in advance. We actually had four panelists for this, and three of them canceled. So I was on the verge of canceling the whole panel, but Xavier was kind enough to do it as a solo. So it's maybe not as well-rounded as it would have been, but I'm still very glad that he's able to carry on the tradition. I'm sorry for that, but that, you know, we're doing the best we can here under trying circumstances. Also, I want to send around the charity collection. Our charity collection this year is for Atlanta Center for Self-Sufficiency. It's a charity for the homeless. And if you'd like more information, there's a sheet of paper in this collection jar that explains more about what they are and what they do.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming out. How's it sound? A little bit. There we go. So like as they described, I was going to be a panelist, kind of just doing the computer security part. That's the computer forensics. That's my specialty. And so I don't know much about, you know, basic forensics. I do have a single slide on it, and it's completely copied from a website. So I will present that. How many here are really interested in the forensics side, the basic forensics? Okay. Good, not a majority, a couple of you. So you'll really enjoy my one slide on forensics. And so I will talk more about the, you know, cyber forensics. That's my specialty, and we got a couple videos, and we'll go kind of jump in here. So what I do right now? I'm a VP at a startup, Drawbridge Networks. Tom Cross is our CTO. He started off the EFF track this morning. So been hacking since the late '80s. Been coming here to DragonCon since the early '90s. And what my relevant technical skills is around, I'm an expert witness in a number of cases, and on cyber forensics. I've done both corporate expert witness and then also for PD. And there's a great organization called HTCIA. It's High Technology Crime Investigation Association. And I was a good standing member of that until I took a job working for the defense. And that's actually against their bylaws. So I'm a bad guy now. So I guess a gray hat forensics person. Personally, I feel like, you know, I do think child porn is bad, but it's also the witch hunt of today. And so, you know, not everybody that has that stuff on their web, on their computer, you know, knowingly downloaded it. And so there is, I think, a good reason for being able to make sure that the people who go to jail for that are the ones that are doing the bad stuff. So, all right, yeah, and I'm a tech alum. So what are we going to do? Like I said, I've got my one slide on cyber forensics. And throughout this, definitely raise your hands and stop me. I want to make this as interactive. You came to see a panel and ask questions and answer. Don't ask me about regular forensics. My CSI knowledge is pretty up there. I've got friends to do it, but yeah, couldn't get them to come down. So for the cyber forensics side, we're going to, you know, look at a couple video clips and, you know, make fun of them. I'm going to teach you about, like, how forensics is been done classically, and then and is still done in any type of police investigations, and then how forensics is moving toward, you know, more of a real-time model, especially in the corporate area. I've got a slide, and I can talk some about Apple and FBI, since that is a, you know, is particularly about, you know, how to get data off of mobile. I've got mobile stuff in here, but if there's a lot of interest, I can talk about that. There's a full session on that later on in the EFF track that will probably touch your fancy a little bit more if you're very interested in that. And then we'll talk about some anti-forensics tools and privacy tools, so that you get both sides of the discussion here, because I'm a bad guy. All right, so here's my one slide on basic forensics. So 10 myths It's read by TV. I like this one, is that forensics only work on murders, and that's not really the case, right? You know, that they have a lot of different things that get pulled into their lab and there really isn't that many people that get murdered. They're very busy people, and it's not all, you know, gruesome SVU type stuff. Another myth, it's a well-paid position. You're up in the 200,000s and driving. You know, you got cool eyeglasses or sunglasses. And that's also not the case. Is that basically the national average for somebody in the forensic field is around 45,000. Another myth is they interrogate subjects and are part of the investigation. Typically, no. And in most cases, most forensics folks are going to be working in a lab, and they get stuff sent to them, and they process it in a very programmatic fashion so that they can so that it's defensible in court, and then they send it back. That's pretty much how it works. DNA evidence is not the end all be all, right? There's, you know, the CSI effect, and if you work in the legal field, is that in jury cases, people think that CSI is the way things happen, and so prosecution will a lot of times try to leverage that to say this is definitive. All of the going back and reanalyzing, you know, cases that have been closed by DNA, that there's a lot of exonerations out there. DNA evidence isn't all that it's cracked up to be. I like this one. Tester done in a matter of hours, right? You know, call down to the lab, and they've got their little spinny thing, and it's done. And again, not the case. There's usually a backlog. And nothing in the legal system works fast. You're looking at weeks, months, according on which lab is doing it. And that forensic analysts never make mistakes. Is that, you know, CSI? They've got their methods, and that's not the case. Every forensics examiner strives to do their best, I'm sure. We're all humans. We all make mistakes. Technology gets better sometimes, and so our methods change over time, and that criminals always make mistakes, that there's some type of like hair somewhere in that crime scene that's going to, you know, prove it, and they get all the evidence in, and they can send back and say non-conclusive, they have no additional evidence to provide to the prosecution. Forensic labs are high tech, and all the like, they definitely go overboard with like the graphical GUIs that, you know, don't exist, but that, you know, that they have all these really specialized equipment, and that again is not really the case. Is that centrifuges to be able to do DNA breakdowns, and it looks a lot more like your high school chemical lab than you would, you know, see it in any type of TV or show. Crimes are solved quickly. This kind of goes back to that, is that that this is a very timely thing. I like this, the last one. That you have to have a one-line catch, catchphrase to be able to solve the case. Yep.
Theme songs,
yep. I hope they do. I would love to meet some forensics folks that were like, hold on, and they push play and they walk into the room. That would be great. And there's the website I stole that from. Pretty much word for word. All right. So I'm going to bring up some of the, you know, the really fake stuff. Most of this I grabbed, I tried to stick to, forensics analysis that catching hackers or finding the hacker, as opposed to really bad hacking scenes, which I love those too, because I've got a couple that might not be exactly forensics, but they're just damn funny, and that's the first one we'll start off with, so I'll play it first, and then I'll tell you if everyone doesn't understand why it's so stupid, then I will there we go. Oh, we lost sound.
GUI interface using Visual Basic. Okay. See if I can track an IP address.
All right. So, where's my controls? Do you see it up there? Oh, that's my timer. Let me see if I can go back a slide. Forward. There we go.
For weeks, I've been investigating the Cabbie Killer murders with a certain morbid fascination.
This is in real time. I'll create a GUI interface using Visual Basic. See if I can track an IP address.
That's great. She's going to create a GUI interface in Visual Basic to track an IP. That's one of the best lines out there, and I had to share that with you. Tracking IP has nothing to do with a GUI interface, and if somebody told me that they were a programmer and still used Visual Basic, I would, you know, cry. And so, yes, yes, yeah. So that was a good one. All right, this next one. Yeah, no, that's just the regular CSI. So she brings up CSI Cyber. Who here has seen episode of CSI Cyber? All right. Yeah, it's what's confusing and hard about that is they throw out lots of real stuff, but they just get a lot of it wrong a little bit. And of course, there's always the over visualizations and the speed of which they do things is off. But also, you know, they throw enough, like I said, they throw enough real stuff where I'm like, okay, no. No. And that generally happens. One of my pet peeves is from, you know, this is just kind of a general computer thing. And they've been doing it in movies and films for like 20 years. Is this.
Okay. Now let's get a good look at you.
Hold it. Run that back.
Wait a minute. Go right. There, freeze that.
Full screen. Okay, freeze that.
Tighten up on that
way. Vector in on that guy by the back wheel.
Zoom in right here on this spot.
With the right equipment, the image can be enlarged and sharpened.
What's that?
It's an enhancement program.
Can you clear that up any?
I don't know. Let's enhance it.
Enhance section A6.
I enhance the detail and...
I think there's enough to enhance. Release it to my screen.
Enhance the reflection in her eye.
Let's run this through video enhancement.
Victor, can you enhance this?
Hang on.
I've been working on this reflection.
Someone's reflection.
Reflection.
There's a reflection of the man's face.
A reflection.
There's a reflection.
Zoom in on the mirror.
You can see a reflection.
Can you enhance the image from here?
Can you enhance him right here?
Can you enhance it?
Can you enhance it?
Can we enhance this?
Can you enhance it?
Enhance it.
Hold on a second, I'll enhance it.
Zoom in on the door.
Times 10.
Zoom.
Move in. More.
Wait, stop.
Stop. Pause it. Rotate 75 degrees around the vertical place.
Stop. Go back to the part about the door again.
Got an image enhancer that can bitmap?
We can use the produce send method to see into the windows.
This software is state of the art.
The eigenvalue is off.
With the right combination of algorithms.
He's taken illumination algorithms to the next level, and I can use them to enhance this photograph.
Lock on and enlarge the z-axis.
Enhance.
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 Freeze and enhance.
Enhance. So yes, that was a great little montage. When I saw that, it was like, this is great. I mean, from 20 years of cinema, you know, that magical button that enhances photos. So to put it into technological terms so that, you know, you actually learn something from tonight, if you don't already know, that basically pixels are pixels. And and that as you, you know, same thing with traditional film, the 35 millimeter was just bigger. It could hold more, you know, chemicals and light than a 110. You know, and so same thing with digital cameras. As you shoot a 5 megapixel, it's going to be more than a, you know, have more data in it than a 2 megapixel. You know, it gets to a point where, you know, if you're zooming in, there's only so much you can do with the information. And that's always been the case. Now, there is some caveats, is that there is some interesting stuff out there that I found. Basically, for motion picture, if they're going through a video surveillance, that basically reducing the noise of the a person moving across the screen, that there is some pretty neat enhancement technology of basically, you know, kind of cleaning that up and getting information from several different pictures and putting them together. And I've just dropped the name of the camera, but there's this camera type that is out there now that allows you to take a picture and then you can focus afterwards. What's it called? Lytra. So that's real, and enhancing video is real, but you're not nothing like what you see in the films. So, all right. So, one more video here, and we'll go into some more content. This one is great because, and I broke it. Apparently. Indeed. I've been hacked. All right, so I'll try to disconnect it. And reconnect. I got a pretty sound. It has detected my source. Oh, that's my desktop. Alright, so escape out of this. Okay. So not reading the picture. Usually once it works for the whole presentation. Aha, look at there. Okay, so one more video. This got some great, you know, just wrongness about technology and catching the hacker. I'll dissect this after we watch.
Trying to decode it, but it could take days.
Still no sign of Feigenbaum trying to attack Augie's site.
No, and Zal Feigenbaum is easily as good a hacker as Augie.
Yeah, he's probably trying to decode the back door too.
You know what if he's not trying to hack Augie? I mean, what if he's trying to find him?
IRC, Internet Relay Chat. It's how hackers talk when they don't want to be overheard.
Kind of true.
It's a pretty primitive chat program.
Think of it like shipping channels in the ocean. You can't see them until a boat cuts through the water, leaving a wake. If two boats meet in the middle of the ocean to swap a load of illegal drugs, you have to catch them in real time. Otherwise, there's no evidence of the meeting left behind.
No names, no account.
Not true.
It's no records of exchange.
Well, how do they see each other?
Online names.
Okay, so what? We got the fist, and what's Augie's?
Oozmeister. Okay, I'll set up an alarm to alert us if either name enters an IRC channel.
And can we see what they're saying?
In Leet speak. Luckily, I speak Leet.
That's so hot.
Leet speak. Here, show of hands, who can speak Leet speak? Anybody? Some 3133 plus. Yeah, okay, good.
All right, Feigenbaum's online.
Okay, I'll get done.
What are they saying?
Yep, our AV guy is back, so the projector basically just loses. Wait, source detect. There we go. Yeah. I enhanced it. I did. Enhanced.
Okay, got a surprise for you. Funny, got one for you too.
You got a trace?
Yeah, but they're probably bouncing off 100 IPs. I mean, they'll be offline before we...
I love technology. All right, so we got pretty much through that. So the idea here is IRC. IRC is one of those ancient protocols that existed before the web on the internet, and it is still used today. A lot of people will hit a website first to do then IRC chat, but it's basically somebody stands up an IRC server, and then you have a client, and the client connects to the IRC server, and you can chat. There's no magic to it. As for the logs and whether or not, you know, your shipping channel doesn't have any evidence, is that it's up to the server administrator whether or not they keep logs, and also if there's any network traffic in between it, you know, that can be to get a man in the middle to steal that data. But yes, IRC does exist. But yeah, the description of the shipping panels is just horrendous. So. All right, so done with some videos, and I'll move on to old school forensics again. Stop me at any time if you have a question. So basically the way that it's done in forensics, and I literally, you know, I think that my first, you know, copying, you know, doing this process was in the mid-90s. And so this is a tried and true approach. It's basically that there's something wrong on a machine that, you know, and so if you're going to do research on it, like it's got malware and you want to learn what the malware did, or you're in a legal situation and your computer's been possessed by the government and is being evaluated for evidence. And so when they send this to the cyber forensics lab, which at last count, Atlanta PD had one FTE doing this, is that you get the device and you're going to make a copy of it. You basically take the raw hard drive, take it out of the computer, you plug it into this device that's called a write blocker, and what that does is it's a hardware device that says you are not going to be able to modify the hard drive. There's no physical way to modify the data on the hard drive. That way you have what's called a chain of evidence. And again, if you're from the legal field, that's very important, especially when it comes to digital evidence, is that you have to prove that chain of custody. So as soon as you make that, you know, bit by bit copy of that hard drive, you can then put the hard drive back in the evidence bag and sign it off and send it back to storage. And then you can do all of your analysis offline. Question, well, you have a cube. They're recording the audio, so do we know where the cube is? She's texting. That's all right. Hold on, let's get this so that your question can be preserved forever. Nope, it's not on? Maybe. All
right, well, it's a good thing I was an instructor, so I've got this down. In the world of cheap SSDs,
There is a lot of this that SSDs kind of changed the way that we do things. There isn't so write blocking, you know, write blockers for SSD. I mean, because that's part of the SATA protocol, so it's not a it doesn't matter whether it's SSD or not for the write blocker. You know, in that instance, you're still, you know, doing that bit for bit for bit copy. There are certain providers of SSDs that provide hardware level access to things like secure wipe and doing bit for bit copies. That then you're tapping into the firmware on the drive to do that and to enable that. And so there's a lot of these things that kind of, you know, get skewed with the newer technology, SSDs being one of them. Did that answer your question? Yeah, I mean, I can go, and we can talk in depth more about it. So you mount the copy, mount that drive for analysis, you look through it. There's all sorts of software out there that can help you break into things if things have been encrypted or secured or hidden. And the forensics analysis job is to go find the evidence. And so they usually have an idea, you know, they have a target to find. If it's a child porn case, they're looking for, you know, pictures and videos. And then they try to create a timeline that shows when this was downloaded and accessed and shared, and so they can provide that timeline back to the prosecution. And so the software that kind of automates a lot of that, and as you go through and you set things up, it uses the file modification, file time date stamps, which I'll talk about again in the anti-forensics, is to build that timeline. And then you produce a report and says, here's the evidence. He had the child porn on his thing, or he, you know, and there's no evidence of malware, because there's a common defense of how that child porn got on there. It must have been a virus. It's normally not. There's not a lot of viruses out there that just spread child porn. There is vindictive second parties, and that's where I've helped on the defense side. Is that, you know, like I said, there are times where they're not guilty. So some of the tools I got listed there, if you're interested. NCASE is one of those that's just kind of been standard for, you know, professionals. It costs money, that's why I say professionals. And then some of the others I've got listed here, I think most of the others are going to be open source. And you can get all the tools on what's called a live CD. And if you're unfamiliar with that term, live CDs are something you download and you're going to burn onto a CD. And then you can insert that CD into a computer and boot up that OS, and you don't have to know anything about, you know, installing Linux on your machine. You keep your Windows 10 with all your games on it, but then when you go do forensics, you use the live CD, and it's much, much easier. And we got a question up front.
Has DiveTribe been replaced by
Kali? Kali, yes. I was putting this on there, I kept thinking of Nopix, and I was like, no, that's not right. So Kali, yeah. You can just tell I'm old. That's where it comes down to the back. I think I might still write that on the CD when I burn a Kali image. But I use live CDs because the amount of tools that are on those CDs, it's just, to me, is ridiculous to sit there and install all of those on a particular machine and have that as a forensic. I don't do this as my day job, so. Sorry?
Flopix.
Yeah, Flopix is it, yeah. USB, you can run live CDs off of USB keys as well. There's tools out there where you don't even have to reboot. You can run the live CD in a virtual machine. Not recommended for doing analysis work. All right, so that's how things have been done, and I've been working for several companies that have changed the story on how to do that. This is more applicable in a corporate space, and so there is lots of forensic analysis that gets done on the corporate level, and so if you're going to take an HR action against somebody for, you know, surfing porn while they're on their computer at work, then you have to, you know, make sure you have the evidence for that before you take the HR action. But nowadays, we can, the computing power and the ability of the operating systems nowadays allows us to track everything in real time. So I used to work for a company called Carbon Black, Bit9, if you're familiar with it. Bit9 is a software that basically looked at every file, and Carbon Black as well, every file that's executable when it gets written, and then when you execute it, what all of the things it does. It does this thing in memory, it writes these other files, and feeds all that information up to a centralized server. And so when you get to do your analysis, you basically, you know, just pull that up and say, you know, here is the bad file. How did that bad file get there? And it, you know, will build a timeline. And this can be done, you know, seconds or minutes after the thing just occurred. And so you can build that timeline, snapshot it, call HR, and move things forward. Of course, it's also used for security. So a lot of the use cases are more, you know, find the Trojan or malware that they download. But that's the idea. I currently work with software. As I told you at the beginning, I work for a company called Drawbridge Networks, and we basically take the concept of that and take it to the network. And so what our software does, is basically looks at every network transaction that occurs, and logs all that in real time, and you can then, you know, build a forensics case based off of that. So you can tie that data together, and of course we're integrated because, you know, used to work for that other company, now I work for this company. So it all works together, and you can do both a network forensics and a process-based forensics and get a full timeline of how things occurred in real time. There's also abilities to grab just the data you need from a system, and so if you want to, you know, grab data, and you can also grab things out of memory if you're doing it in real time. If there's certain really high-tech tools that you can hide stuff only in memory, you can create RAM drives, and that stuff will go away when you turn the machine down. And so It does. This does happen sometimes in evidence cases. A lot more with a mobile phone analysis. But the idea is that if you can get a computer live, still running, you can do a lot more with it than you can with something that's shut down. And you're just looking at the data on the hard drive because you're forgetting all the stuff that goes on, and it's hard to build that timeline and find things that are hidden in memory. Yep, question? We got the mic working now.
So from a law enforcement perspective, if the law enforcement person is actively on the system, you know, they're making changes to it. It's no longer the old school where you have a preserved copy and that there's no evidence of law enforcement tampering. You have the law enforcement person there doing things. How do you establish that the evidence is clean?
So there's a lot of this. So we start off, and if you want to hand that, if we take a step back a decade and look at what we're doing there, it was all on like firewall logs, and we were looking at what people were doing, and the logging subsystem of those basically makes it so that it's very easy to use from a technology perspective, but doesn't have a chain of evidence. It's not non-refutable, but that the process of how you obtain that information can be presented in a court of law. It just doesn't have that that firmness of that. But there was case law built on that, you know, on presenting firewall logs in the court case, and don't have them in the top of my head, but that built the case law that allows us to continue to build off of that. And so with the new technology, if you can, you basically, some of the process is having a third party audit the collection technology, and then being able to present, you know, if it's open source, then it's great because you can see the source and you can have a third party say there's nothing funky going on here, and you just step through the process of how it works. And yeah, defense will come at you, but that's you can still present it in a court of law because of presenting logs back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Okay, question?
All right, why wouldn't you do your collection of your three and use a 5D MD5 hash? So if you actually have the machine, then you can turn around and you can verify what's been changed by bit count.
When you have a whole disk image, yes, that's...
If you actually catch the actual machine, but at the same time, what a lot of people are forgetting, not all the information is just on the machine. If you have the router that it's going to, you can actually pull the data from that router. It's not just the machine that holds the information.
Right.
And you can trace it back. That's how a lot of people get caught in the back end.
Right, yeah. Yeah, all the networking information is... and the reason that... you know, plug my company again, is that, you know, by getting the data from the source, ours is an agent-based solution, so we're getting all that network data collection from the machine itself, and when the kernel tells you what it's doing, it's a little bit more non-refutable, but not completely. And there was a question up front over here.
Okay, so talking about the level of assurance, or how much confidence we would have in a certain type of evidence. I just wanted to see if I can get your thoughts on some of the state-sponsored attacks. You know, with the whole Sony thing that we had last year, mm-hmm. it seemed like the FBI came out within a week and said, hey, this is North Korea. And we know just from a technical standpoint how challenging attribution can be. So I wanted to see if I could get your opinion, maybe what level of skepticism do you think we should have when we hear these things from maybe the FBI or maybe the Secret Service or other government law enforcement organizations?
Yeah, it's a great topic. A little off topic, but a great question. I'll answer it quickly. Is that you should always meet it with a high level of skepticism. You're looking at the company that made that claim. So it wasn't the FBI that told that figured this out. It was Mandiant, and so Mandiant was federal contractor that was doing the analysis. Also, Bit9 and Carbon Black, we were there, helping Sony to be able to do some. They hire several teams, and so you know we weren't hired by the FBI. We were hired by Sony, and so attribution is hard. And so what they look at is if they can get once they get the malware, you can break it apart and look at how a program is built, and if you already have samples from that group that use the same coding structure, same comments, reuse modules. I mean, this is all malware nowadays is not a kid in the basement coming up with a 100 line code that does reboot the internet grid, right? You've got teams of professional programmers writing this stuff, and they're managed just like any other software team, and so they reuse software, reuse modules in their software a lot. So that's one way of attribution. Other way is the infrastructure of a hack often involves using intermediate servers that are already hacked, right, so that I can move around and talk around and communicate. And if you're using the same infrastructure, that's also another attribution tactic. So that's the methods of attribution. It's not it's not hard science. And so everybody was surprised how quickly they came out and said it was North Korea. And being in the security field, I also had my skepticism arm on, but that's how you take that. All right, another question?
To throw out a hypothetical, like I'm the CTO of a major company. I don't know we've been hacked, but I want to know if we've been hacked. Is such a service available? Like we have no idea if our data is compromised, but we want an audit of that possibility. Is that there?
Oh yeah. So.
And what form does it take?
Basically, you're looking at you're looking for a security assessment, or a pen test. So pen test is short for penetration test, and there are lots of companies out there that will basically are. Hackers that you hire. You ever remember the movie Sneakers from back in the 80s? I mean, those companies exist in droves. They're usually fairly small and compact, and a lot of local companies that can come out and basically try to hack you and tell you where you're vulnerable. Security assessments will take a more holistic approach and kind of analyze the data that you've. How you've structured your IT, and look for they're not going to necessarily try to hack the system, but they're going to see, all right, you're running this software and you're doing it in this way, and that is not a very secure way of doing it, and therefore finding footprints, yes, those companies provide those services as well, and when we talk about the point in which people realize that they're hacked. There's two interesting bits of data there. One is time to know that you're hacked. And it's currently in the months, like 9-10 months range, average of all the, so there's some that are like, 2 or 3 years, they've been owned for that long and didn't notice, and then there's people that have some newer software that allows them to see those attributes sooner. So that's interesting. And then the other aspect is, length of it. Where you find out. A lot of times, most companies get called by the FBI. They'll get called by Visa, MasterCard, and say that you're owned. Or some other type of large. Sometimes Microsoft has a big team that does it. Google and Facebook have really good teams, but they don't necessarily out there looking for everyone else. But that's generally like when they see evidence being published on the dark web, and it's got your domain names in it, they'll call you up. And so there's actually, I think it's like 60 or 70% of companies find out from a third party that they've been hacked. Best way is one, bring in hackers to look around, and then they're going to recommend software that does more real-time analysis, allows you to see more and collect more. Because this change has only happened in the last 5 or 6 years, a lot of the security organizations don't have the funding to buy all this new software, and so And when you get those recommendations, you come by and buy our product at Drawbridge Networks. So.
Yeah, actually, I was going to hit on that same topic. If you don't actually have the data coming in with a tool that is looking at your logs, looking at everything that's happening across your network, you're never going to have one of these folks be able to help you. So you've got to start there before you can even know you've got a problem.
Yep.
To go back over that, something corporations need to pay attention now, as he stated, within the 5 years it's changed. Security is a big thing, you need to pay attention. It's kind of the field that I'm also in. I would say you want to use a UTM, a Unified Threat Manager, and there is a lot of them out there, as he stated. So a Unified Threat Manager will track information going out, going in, as long as you have somebody who's monitoring it. If you're not monitoring it, it doesn't matter.
Thank you. So I'm going to skip this next one, next video here, and talk about Apple versus FBI. So there's lots of aspects of this I can go into. We've only got about 20 minutes left, and I want to have some time to talk about anti-forensics and privacy stuff. And so I want to just gauge the interest in the room about going into this topic. It's related to forensics and so much that it was the FBI trying to get this, and it seemed like a very interesting topic to bring up. So hands of room, you want me to go over this, or you just come back to the big session later? All right, so I think that's enough hands. All right, so leading up to the incident, we're going to set the stage, put the context around this. 2014, Apple releases iOS 8. Security enhancement in there basically said that when you get your phone, you put in your passcode, and it starts encrypting your device with a key that Apple doesn't have, and the key is stored on your phone, on your device, and the only way to unlock that key is to put in your passcode, and so the only way to unencrypt your device, so your whole device is encrypted, most of it, we'll get to that, is, and so you have to put in a passcode. So that's where we're at with the technology. I'll probably skip some of the other the federal stuff about the vulnerable equities process, but it goes to answer a question at the very end of this story. But basically, there is a policy that the U.S. government has on if they find a vulnerability, how do they go about doing it? Do I give it to my hacking team, my red team, the guys in Army Cyber that are going to go out and use it as an offensive tool? Like there's a vulnerability that maybe we only know about, so I'm going to use it to hack our adversaries. Or do I publish it or go contact the manufacturer of that software and let them know that they have a vulnerability? But it's got a lot of history to it, but basically Heartbleed was one of those that kind of brought this to the surface. It was a huge vulnerability, and there was a story that got put out that said NSA knew about Heartbleed and was hiding it. That's been proved false, but that at least made the NSA step up and actually respond, because NSA normally says, "I'm sorry, we're not going to comment." That's we don't even exist, right? So they actually came out and actually talked about this process, and then Obama kind of put some more language around it. It became stronger, and then through a Freedom of Information Act, EFF obtained the actual VEP process. That's been written out. Of course, a lot of it there's some redactions in there, but through the process, I'm just. Put it up on the screen real quick. Basically there is a formal process, so our government does care about this, and what's great is that the people that look at and make the decision on whether or not to use it offensively or defensively are part of the defense side of the NSA, and so that's a good thing. That means that most of the vulnerabilities that they published, 91% disclosed. That's an NSA came out and said that since this date, we have disclosed 91% of the vulnerabilities that we found. And so the government in general And there's this great reference, get this data from, where they go out and prove that this is probably correct. All right, so just enough on that. That's just to kind of answer this last question. So what happened is, a judge said, we need to get into this iPhone, and Apple, you're going to do it. And Apple says, well, I don't have the key, so I can't just unlock the phone. And then there's other security measures in there. It says if you type in your password too many times, it's going to wipe the device. So I can't brute force. I can't sit there and try every combination. The vulnerability that exists is that if you can basically your whole system is encrypted, but it's your data, and so the software that runs iOS, that does the password stuff, obviously has to be unencrypted, because you got to put in your code first to unencrypt it, right? So you got to be able to get to the lock, and so the lock itself, that software that does the lock, is in clear text. And so if you were to be able to hook that phone up and convince it to do an update of that software, then you could get into that phone. So basically, that's why the truth of the matter is that the judge was basically saying, we need you to write software to hack your own iOS. And Apple stood the ground, and they told him no. Eventually FBI got a third-party company that says we'll do it. Sure, it's a couple $1 million, but they came in and did what they asked, and produced and basically unlocked the phone for them. They're like, hey, give me the phone, all right, here you go, it's unlocked. The question is, all right, so you got this vulnerability, right? It's going to go through the vet process, and that's as obviously, everybody knows. So you're just going to tell Apple, right? FBI goes, well, they just did it for us, so we don't know the vulnerability, so therefore we can't disclose it. And it was just—I still am a little upset about that, the process is there, so they set up the situation just right, and so there was they still in the end got the device unencrypted, and Apple stood its ground, which was great, and stands a lot of precedence. So we got a question here.
Although this would be a pain in the butt to do, would it be possible just to keep cloning the phone and then brute forcing the PIN, since it's just usually just a PIN password on them?
Cloning the process of phone is not as straightforward as with a hard drive. You only have that, the lightning connector ability to connect to the device. And so when you send a command over that, there's only certain things that are going to respond, especially if the phone is locked. You can still do iOS updates through that or over the wire, and so you can still go in there and convince it to update, but you're not going to be able to clone the entire phone.
And also, I heard that with this particular one, after you get the wrong one enough times, the time difference between when you can try again increases.
Right. Yes. So and so that's part of the. Yeah.
And that's probably a deal breaker.
Yeah, is it? Yeah. Okay. All right, so still got a good bit of time here. So anti-forensics, this is the bad stuff, right? As much as I'm a huge supporter of privacy. You see my NSA shirt here. It's got lots of ironic quotes from Snowden and lots of people. So I'm not here to support the NSA. I do know people that work there, and they all do great work. But that the idea of unlimited surveillance, I think that we do have a right to privacy, and so because these tools exist. I wanted to kind of introduce them to you, and so just to kind of give you the full story about forensics is that people can do stuff to mess up forensics in a case. And if you think about, you know, in a Atlanta PD, you know, one person running through and scanning all these drives, it's a very robotic process, you know, and so if a time, like the first bullet I got there is, you know, there's tools in there that will allow you to go in and to change the metadata about a file. You know, it says that it was created on January 1st, but, 2016, but I can change it to say 1970. Or and, you know, set them all at the same time, or just recreate, and the time state stamps to say that it's never been accessed, because that's an attribute as well, that it's never been read. Because on the child porn side, you have to knowingly download child porn, knowingly obtain and own. And so if it's just on your machine, that's a case for, and you can prove that you never saw the photos, or the videos, that is a case defense. And any of those that I presented through the Atlanta the defense counsel down here, they dropped the cases. So timelines, you mess with timelines, that can be one way of messing up forensics. And so scrubbing deleted files. So when you do a forensic analysis, you can find stuff on the hard drive that you might not even be able to see in your normal operating, when you're booting up your normal operating system. And so when you delete files, they just kind of say, I'm just going to forget that this file exists. And it still is there, but that, you know, it's got a little bit that says, nope, I've already deleted this file. And when you need space, you can rewrite over that, but there's no cleaning of that file. There's no real deletion. It just kind of gets marked as deleted. And so if you've got a hard drive bit for bit for copy, then you can retrieve that deleted data. And so one way of messing that up is, of course, if you scrub deleted files. And there's software out there that will do that, secure trash bin, you look for those type of tools, and you can be able to, every time you delete a file, they will scrub the contents of that file, write it with random characters a couple of times, and that way the magnetic media doesn't store that. Different stories of SSDs and the capabilities of getting that data off of SSDs is still evolving. Scrub the metadata. So the This is a good note. If you send, especially if you send files around, so everybody writes a Word document, a PowerPoint, and they email it to people maybe outside their company. The amount of metadata in those files, Microsoft's gotten a lot better about this, but in Microsoft Office, it's a surprising amount of stuff. There's changes that have been made by previous parties. There's editors. There's names of people that if you're connected to Active Directory and you do Office 365, their domain accounts will be in that metadata. So anytime that you're dealing with files like that, and you want to keep that clean, at least in Office, you can actually do that from the tool itself. You can Google on how to do that, but it's pretty basic to kind of go and remove the metadata. So anytime you're going to email out a Word document, always go and if newer version of Windows, you just hit the home button, or the one that's right and left to the left of File, and there's a button right there on that screen that says review or analyze metadata, and you can clean that out. If you're done with the hard drive, you're done with the machine, you're sending it back to corporate, you're selling it, or you're just doing whatever, there is a tool called DBAN. That's right. Boot and Nuke, I just forgot the D's. But basically, it's old software that's been around forever, that's been updated over time, and allows you to securely remove the data from that drive. It does the same thing as scrubbing a file that we were talking about before, but does it from a whole drive perspective. That's just, you do that every time. If that will make sure that none of your data will move on. Now, caveat as to that is SSDs. Is that your question about SSDs? Okay, let me get through this and I get your question. So SSDs it's actual, you know, memory, physical memory, and so it's electrons in a certain place and not magnetic, and so what the drive manufacturers have done is allowed for a process of being able to talk directly to the drive and tell it to do a secure wipe. And what it does is basically runs the hardware to reset all that memory so that it's completely done. There's still a lot of investigation going on into, is that really secure? Is there anything I can do about that? I've read, you know, stories on both sides, so I'm not going to be taking a side on that. Is that it still may be possible on SSDs to get the data after you've done a secure wipe through the firmware. So okay.
As far as you were talking about the disk wiping software, how effective is DD in just pointing /dev/say null to overwrite the hard drive? Would that be just as effective?
Yeah, I mean, so there's DMAN, what it does is you can wipe your drives with all zeros or all ones, mm-hmm. or you can do random characters, and then you can go and do multiple passes like that. And so, yes, you can get that done with DD and a lot of other tools. DMAN is just a boot CD or USB drive, and so it boots and nukes it. Yeah, so. So my time, we got about four more minutes here. So encrypt your data, that's an obvious one. Many tools, unless you're getting caught by the NSA, are secure enough to be able to, hide data from. Now the problem is with standard encryption, if they see an encrypted file, the prosecution is going to just say, all right, we're subpoena the key. We need you to provide the key. I can do a whole nother presentation on the legality of that, but the bottom line is they can do it, and that they can. So encryption alone is not going to get you out of everything, but that looking at encrypted solutions allows you to give some anti-forensics capabilities. And then last one is top on mobile, and we'll just finish up with questions. So mobile, if you get a phone and you're going to give it to somebody else, you're taking a SIM card out, you're selling it, whatever, and you go and you reset, maybe you put your password in wrong and it resets it, or you go to the settings and you say restore factory settings. That does not delete your data at all. Now, remember, Apple devices still, it will re-encrypt with a new key once you set that up, and so it's harder to get off for all Android, and I'm sure Windows Phone as well, is that you basically can then take a device that's just been reset, plug it in your computer, it'll mount, and you can see all the data there. It's not even deleted. It's still there. So there is a Google on different tools that allow you to actually secure wipe a phone. That's a big thing. And Android does have encryption. You can do the same thing on Android that iPhone does by default, but it's not turned on by default for most operating systems. Questions.
Is there a specific tool that you've used in the past, like PhotoRec, that's the best for like just recovering photos, regardless of which type of partition it is?
My experience is kind of off and on, right? So I do moonlighting consulting on this, and so I'm on a list of expert witnesses, and so every now and once a blue moon, I'll have somebody call me up, and I'll go and do this, and so I just go and look at what's the newest best, for finding, for recovering files off of that have been previously deleted. It's really not. There really hasn't been a lot that changes there, and being able to recover that. There are newer technologies where you can encrypt a drive and hide it in unpartitioned space, and so some of the newer tools will then also detect that stuff as well. So, question in the back.
Yeah, so I've heard it before. I'm not sure if it's like a wives' tale or anything, but on hard drives, if you have a file and you erase it with zeros, ones, whatever, one pass, that you know, you can use like a scanning electron microscope to actually read the disk platter itself and
yes.
reconstruct the ghosts of bits, or with SSDs, you know, the wear leveling that occurs that will have, you know, your file still intact on a part of the disk that's there. What I'm actually curious about is where in the course of the investigation would that occur? Like, if I'm a high profile target and you suspect that I've even tried to securely delete my files, when would you go to that actual, like, extreme effort to try to do that? Because surely,
it's going to be a cost of the prosecution, and so it'll be the prosecution's office on deciding whether or not they want to pay for those external services. So I've worked for the prosecution. I've worked with Atlanta PD Cyber. They will get backed up, and at the time, you know, this was I would just get called to come in and help out in a few cases, and so that's just a budgetary question about the prosecution, of course, high profile cases and whatnot. So, hey, question up here. Yep, mic's coming your way. Oh, do we run out of battery? Out of time? All right. Well, can you get with this question? Yep.
All right. This is kind of an off-topic, off-topic question, but the nature of the forensics kind of might lead to an answer, and it's kind of a question for the whole room, I suppose. But it's an application question regarding Google Chrome. I used to use Google Chrome a lot as my primary browser, and I've since switched to Firefox because while looking through the Google Chrome's cache on my hard drive, I noticed a bunch of images and even some movie files that I could have swore I had never ever seen before, and they were downloaded, and I'm under the impression that Google Chrome was sharing my cache with other users, because I've always heard around the internet that, oh, Google Chrome's a botnet, don't use it, et cetera, but I never paid that much mind because it was like random users on Slashdot or whatever. But seeing a bunch of images in the browser's cache that it seemed to me I couldn't possibly have downloaded, it seemed to kind of throw some new light onto that.
Probably what you're seeing there is called pre-caching. And it's where browsers try to make it appear that they're so fast, is that they will start downloading stuff that they think you might click on. And so that's the only thing. Google, I've worked with Google a number of times over my career. And you know, they're serious about security. Mozilla Foundation as well. I mean, so you're not going to go wrong with Firefox or Chrome. You can so on the privacy list, you know, one of the things I talk about is you can go out and take a look at, here's some secure settings. So the website I have there, privacytools.io, they have on that for Firefox. They have here's all the configuration settings that you might want to tweak to give yourself more privacy. And so, I don't think that there's anything more nefarious going on there other than pre-catch. All right, so we've run out of time, and I appreciate you all coming and listening to just me. And y'all have a good con.